It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Later in the hour, Wisconsin ranks among worst in the nation for disparities between African Americans and Caucasians in education and the workplace. We'll speak with a pastor who has set out to name and address some of those inequalities.
Right now, though, our next guest captivated readers when he published The Autobiography of an Execution, a book that chronicled his experience defending inmates on death row in Texas.
Attorney David Dow led his clients through the appeals process, managing the balance of hope, truth, and family relationships for inmates when faced with death.
David has now published a new book about another personal experience with a death sentence, this time in the form of his father-in-law's cancer. David Dow is the Cullen Professor at the University of Houston Law Center. His new book is called Things I've Learned from Dying, a book about life. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
It's really a compelling book. And in Things I've Learned from Dying, you're trying to appeal the death sentence of Eddie Waterman before his execution date. Now, you've worked on behalf of hundreds of death row inmates, but this case was different for you. Why was that?
It was different, I think, for a couple of reasons. Number one, because it overlapped with, of course, the other two stories that I tell in the book that you mentioned, one of which you mentioned in the introduction, the death of my father-in-law, who died from melanoma when he was only 60 years old. He was diagnosed when he was 58 years old, and the day that I was appointed to represent Mr. Waterman, whom I write about in the book, was basically the same day. I think that it was either one day before or one day after he was diagnosed with the melanoma. So that's one of the reasons. And then the other reason is that he was just a particularly compelling person to write about. I thought in the last book of mine that you mentioned in the introduction, The Autobiography of an Execution, I wrote about somebody who I believe to this day was actually innocent, even though he was executed. Mr. Waterman, who I write about in the current book, is not innocent, never claims to be innocent. There was never any question about his participation in the crime. And yet he struck me as somebody who many reasonable people, including many supporters of the death penalty, would think should not be executed. And so those were a couple of the reasons that I chose to focus on him in this book.
So as you said, not only in the same period, but really at the same time, you're dealing with this case of Eddie Waterman trying to get his sentence commuted. And your father-in-law, Peter, is diagnosed with advanced and terminal cancer. And it really struck me that Peter and Eddie really couldn't be more different in so many ways. Peter planned out his life to the last detail. He's a German scientist, and it really comes through. And Eddie is about to lose his life because of really not thinking through what the ramifications were going to be for his future of a certain act. Yet there they are, both fighting for their lives, and you're accompanying them through that.
Yes, and your observation is exactly correct. At one level, they could not have been more different. My father-in-law, as you mentioned, was a chemist. He was a PhD in chemistry. He spent most of his professional life as a laboratory scientist, and he spent the latter part of his professional life as a manager, managing other laboratory scientists. He was also an extremely avid and accomplished outdoorsman. He's one of these guys who was hiking across Nepal and Tibet and Bhutan 35, 40 years ago before people could carry a satellite beacon with them so that they could get rescued if they got lost. And on the other hand, Eddie Waterman is somebody who never even finished junior high school, middle school. He's somebody who had never traveled anywhere, never been on an airplane, never been on a train. And so in that respect, you're right, they could not have been more different. My father-in-law was a genuine intellectual who loved to read about art and science and music, and Eddie Waterman was barely literate. He read at about a sixth or seventh grade level. And so, yes, in most respects that we think of as defining who human beings are, they were opposites. They were barely members of the same species, and yet they were in my life at exactly the same time. And there was one aspect of each of their lives that was, in fact, mirrored in the other. My father-in-law had two children. He had a son and he had a daughter, who was, of course, my wife. And Eddie Waterman also had a daughter. And, of course, the difference between them, or a difference between them, is that my father-in-law and his daughter were extremely close. And therefore, when he was diagnosed with cancer, there were some real tensions between him and my wife, because she wanted him to pursue a regime of therapy that he was reluctant to pursue. On the other hand, Eddie Waterman had a daughter from whom he had been estranged for many years. And what he most wanted before he was finally executed was to try to reestablish that relationship and that connection with this daughter of his, who he literally had not seen in 10 or 11 years, and who, by the time I knew him, was already a student in college who had had no contact with her dad from the time that he had gone into prison.
And as you mentioned, as if dealing with these two situations wasn't already a lot to bear, your beloved dog, Winona, is also stricken with cancer at the same time. And you say that in some ways it was that loss, the loss of Winona, that was the hardest of the three deaths to come to terms with. And I think some people might flinch when they first hear that.
I think some people would flinch, although I suspect that most people who have had to euthanize a pet, whether it's a dog or a cat, would at least have a little bit of sympathy for me. I've been a dog person my entire adult life, and there were a couple of things about Winona's death that made it the most difficult of these three for me to deal with. One, of course, is that it's the only one of the three cases where I was actually making the decision to end the life. In the case of my client, I was doing everything I could to save him. In the case of my father-in-law, I was doing everything that I could to be with him and to participate in his making the decisions about what he was going to do. But with the dog, it was my wife and I who were making the decisions. We got this dog shortly before we were married, as a matter of fact. And the dog had spent nearly 24 hours a day with me. She would go with me to my office. She would go with me when I traveled. And she did not get ill suddenly. She got ill dramatically. She went from being extremely robust and healthy one day to being at death's door the next. It was really like falling off of a cliff because of this acute liver failure that she developed. And I think that one of the reasons that that struck me the hardest is because I had the least amount of time to prepare for it, but also because it was ultimately my wife and me who made the decision when to end her life. And then, of course, the final piece of the dog narrative, at least another reason that I think that it was very impactful on me, was because our son, who's now 13, was 8 years old at the time that the dog died. And the dog was a dog that had been in his life, our son's life, literally from the day we brought him home from the hospital. And I think that I didn't appreciate the intensity of the bond that our son had with the dog. And so I think that I made some decisions about how to treat the dog that were not sufficiently attentive to the depth of the relationship between our son and the dog. So that's a bunch of different reasons. And what they all added up to for me was an unusually traumatic experience. The other thing I think that I would like to say in my own defense here on in just at least in terms of how I reacted to that particular death is that, as I said, I've been a dog owner my entire adult life, and so I'd had to euthanize other animals before. And the dog that I had had to euthanize immediately before the dog that I write about in the book, the dog that I write about in the book is a female Doberman named Winona. And immediately before Winona, I had a dog named Whitney, and Whitney died from spinal cancer. And when I say she died from it, of course, what I mean is that she had spinal cancer and I made the decision to have her euthanized. And in the case of Whitney, the previous dog, the moment that it was the right moment to do that was perfectly clear to me. There was one day I woke up in the morning and she could no longer stand. She couldn't move. She didn't want to eat anything at all. And it was clear to me that she did not want to live anymore, that she was in so much pain that she didn't want to live anymore. And I made the mistake, it turns out in retrospect, of inferring from that episode that the decision when to end the life of a pet would always be clear. It was so clear to me in that instance that I thought it would always be clear. And what turned out to be the case with Winona is that it wasn't clear at all. And to this day, I don't know if my wife and I waited a day too long, a week too long, or whether we made the decision a day or a week or a month too early. And the regret that is entangled with that uncertainty is yet another reason that that's a particularly impactful story.
And David, the subtitle of your book is A Book About Life. Why was that important for you to include?
I wish that I had thought of the subtitle. The publisher called me shortly before we went to press and said to me that they had been talking about the book in the office and they wanted to run by this idea that they hoped I didn't think was going to be too cheesy. And he said, we want to have a subtitle, A Book About Life. And I said, oh my gosh, not only do I not think it's cheesy, I wish that I had thought of that myself because it seemed absolutely right to me. The central events in the book are that these three people die. Waterman dies, my father-in-law dies, our dog dies. But what the book is really about, in my view, is the effect that those deaths have on the relationships of all of the people who love the person who's facing death and how they change those people in ways that are in part good. And those good changes, of course, continue to be present in the lives of the people who survive the three deaths that I write about. So it's called A Book About Life because even though the three central narratives revolve in one way or another around these three beings whose lives are ending, the equally important story and maybe even more important story that I wanted to tell is about the way the people who survive those deaths live the rest of their lives.
David, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for giving me the time.
We've been speaking with law professor David Dow about his new book, Things I've Learned from Dying, A Book About Life.
Many people are off work today for the Martin Luther King Jr. observation, a day to reflect on, in part, the civil rights movement in America. Our next guest says there's a lot of improvement to be made when it comes to civil rights issues here in Wisconsin. In education, for example, fourth and eighth grade black students have the lowest average reading ability in the country with the widest achievement gap of any state.
And black males are incarcerated at the highest rate in the country, meaning that half of all black men will spend time in jail by the time they are 30. And in Wisconsin, African-American babies are three times more likely to die before they turn one than white babies.
Reverend Alex G. of the Fountain of Life Covenant Church has been addressing these issues publicly since he wrote an op-ed in the Capital Times last month titled Justified Anger. He joined us back then to talk about some of the issues. We wanted to have him back on to have more focused discussion on what kind of solutions the state and local communities could aim for. Reverend Alex G. is here with us in the studio. Reverend G., welcome back to Central Time.
It's really wonderful to be here again. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, we laid out some of those statistics. Why, this is a huge question, but why Wisconsin? Why do we have such significant racial disparities even compared with other states?
Well, I mean, I know those statistics so well. I quote them all the time, but every time I hear them, I become a little depressed. So even as you said it, I think I fought back a few tears. I think a number of things can contribute to it. I feel that Wisconsin has, you know, we have the state motto of forward. We want to be progressive in our thinking and our actions. And sometimes because we have a history, you know, Madison's known as the Berkeley of the Midwest. When I travel, people talk about how open and liberal we are. I think sometimes we rest so much on our laurels that we don't think we have any work to do today. Our population of color has increased drastically, but I don't think that we paid attention to disproportionate numbers of African Americans in the criminal justice system as attorneys, judges, teachers, educational administrators. That has not grown accordingly or proportionately. And I think we have this sense that we love everyone, we get along, it doesn't really matter who you are and what your background is. And I think because we look the other way, we've allowed this to happen. One of the things that surprises me is particularly as I do call-in radio programs, I'm actually having an ongoing debate with middle-aged white men who are trying to argue me down that it should not matter what color a mentor is, that that is reverse discrimination for me to insinuate that we need more black male teachers and role models. And some of my strongest childhood advocates and role models are still my friends to this day, like my third grade teacher, Eric Lilliquist. So I'm not saying that we can't do that cross-culturally, but just the fact that we're arguing that it's not important to have that is why I think we continue to have these problems. We're just unaware.
Speaking of awareness, do you think, I mean, those numbers have been bouncing around out there about those disparities, but are Wisconsinites aware of it? Do they feel it? Do they really get it?
I don't think so. I think we're stunned. I think we feel that somehow the numbers are skewed. People have been so silent on the Race to Equity report. But before that, there was the State of Black Madison. And then there was a La Follette report that came out about Milwaukee schools in the 80s, early 90s. I think we keep feeling that we're going to wake up. Someone's going to clarify. And they're going to say, this isn't really so bad. Or what we're doing now is we're blaming it on people from Chicago or from the South. So these could not be our people skewing these statistics. They've got to be outsiders.
So there isn't even agreement that there is a problem.
I think because it's getting so much attention, and now because we trail the nation when it comes to the incarceration or leave, whichever way you're looking at it, because of the bad press we're getting, I think we're forced to look at it. And so I think we just kept feeling that it would go away if we just get kind enough people in roles or positions. We tried to fix it without bringing people who are indigenous to the communities that are losing out to the table. And that's a huge mistake.
We mentioned education, incarceration, and health. What do you see as the most alarming things going on in Wisconsin right now?
I would say the achievement gap. Mm-hmm. As you were listing the gap, how we're the worst state in the nation between the achievement gap between black and white students, it's appalling. Particularly since every one of our schools in this community is in the backyard or the shadow of the University of Wisconsin, it's unconscionable. That shouldn't happen. And the reason I address that one is because historically for African Americans who have lacked fathers or economic means, education was our way out. And so when educational systems are failing, there's absolutely no way out of abject poverty.
You mentioned earlier that argument with largely middle-aged white men over the idea, the importance of mentors, teachers who are African American. Why is that important? Why does that make a difference?
Well, let me just say this. We state it as if African-Americans need something that their white counterparts don't. If you just think about your teachers growing up, I'm sure most of them look like you, whether they're male or female. So when I say it would have helped me growing up in Madison, having had only one African-American male teacher in my life, it would have helped me to see more teachers look like me who were interested in science or the humanities or graduate programs. And so we're not saying that African-Americans need something that other people don't. We're saying our white counterparts have always had teachers, administrators, textbooks who look like them. So we're not asking for anything different. We're just saying, hey, us, you know, us too. My daughter has the grades to go to medical school. But in this community, she has never laid eyes on an African-American physician. Ever, and she's 17.
So if I grow up, I see, I'm white, if you hadn't caught on, in radio land. If I see a white doctor, white teachers, white presidents, politicians, those all kind of become built in as part of my range of options.
Exactly.
And if
it's
I hadn't seen that, maybe they wouldn't.
Exactly. Exactly. Because think of the things that you assume you can't do because you've not seen. You've not witnessed someone do because it's done by people of other ethnic backgrounds. And so it's just a way of reinforcement when you see administrators or teachers or people who look like you. And so when all the images are negative, you don't see anything positive in your textbooks. It just begins to make it just causes you to question what you can or what you can't do.
How do you make that happen? How do you get those role models out there front and center?
Well, the role models are they're interested. They want to get involved. And sometimes there's red tape. I mean, one of the things that I want to talk with the superintendent about, and I sat next to the state superintendent today at the Rotunda, and he and I said that we're going to get together. I want to know why individuals can't have either emergency credentials or whatever the specialized credentials are so that someone, I have an undergraduate degree in African-American history. Why can't I teach at a local high school on a part-time basis? If we have less than 2% students of color, I mean, teachers of color for a school district that's largely becoming multi-ethnic, why can't we do something that's almost a desperate measure to bring more people of color into the classrooms? I think we start right there. Bring volunteers and teachers into the community.
We're speaking with Reverend Alex G. of the Fountain of Life Covenant Church. We're talking about racial disparities in Wisconsin and what might be done to close the gaps.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you notice racial inequalities in your daily life? Tell us about your experience and what you think can or should be done to change these things. And do you think Reverend G's suggestion that the educational achievement gap is the highest priority to close? We'd like to have you join us. You can call 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're back with Reverend Alex G. of the Fountain of Life Covenant Church, and we're discussing how Wisconsinites can help change racial disparities in our state.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you think Wisconsin has a lot of ground to make up when it comes to racial disparities? What changes would you like to see happen? Call us at 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll get your calls in just a couple of minutes, but first, Reverend G., you've got a community forum coming up. Can you tell us about that?
I sure can. People have been asking since the article was printed on December 18th, what's the next step? And I've wanted to just let the information just steep and brew with people so that we wouldn't just rush to a solution and not really feel the brunt of all those dismal facts. But on Saturday, we're having a town hall meeting. It'll be February 15th from 2 to 4 p.m. At our facility on 633 West Badger Road. And we're going to be meeting with community leaders and helping them to speak into some of the solutions. We don't want to come up with all the solutions. We have ideas of the areas that we want to rally around. But I really feel that this has got to be a community solution. So we want to have town hall meetings where people get to speak their minds and share their suggestions so that they really feel good about the process. And if people want to find out more about that, they can email me at justifiedanger@nehemiah.org. That's NEHEMIAH.
If we're talking about Madison or any other community or even at a statewide level, who needs to be at the table for this kind of conversation?
I say any concerned individual. I'm receiving emails from mental health professionals, professors, social workers, police officers. I just think people want a place to talk about it. I believe that we have it within us in the greater Madison area to really address these issues. I just think we've just been asleep at the wheel. And so I have been inundated by notices, notes, calls, people just showing up, Googling me, visiting, which is reassuring. People are saying, we want to talk about this. So I feel that there's going to be a strong educational component because there are so many people who are unaware. And once they're educated, they can be real allies for change. So what we want to do is educate those who are learners, let those who want to mingle have chances to interact, and those that are ready to go because they're experienced, who want to plug it into some action. We want to take people and plug them in where they're best prepared to connect. But we want to meet people where they are. But I want the community to know we want to talk about this and not just shove solutions down their throats. Madisonians want to talk.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Henry on the line in Milwaukee. Henry, hi.
How you doing today?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Yeah, I want to say regarding suggesting that social workers, police officers, educators are asleep at the wheel, kind of disregards the glaring fact. How about the fathers in these kids' lives being asleep at the wheel or not there altogether? You can't expect a child to go into a world where he's to be educated no matter how much money you throw at it when his home life is completely fragmented or there's an auntie or a grandma raising him. How about babies stop having babies and get more of a family structure and let's start talking about where it all begins in the home? How about some talk about deadbeat dads?
Henry, thanks for the call. This is a common response, I think, on these issues. It's families that
sure.
are the problem.
But Henry misread my or misunderstood my point. I said society. I said our community is asleep at the wheel and not responding to this. My daughter has a father. I was in the delivery room, and there are still things that I need to advocate for because of what's happening to her in terms of being told she can't make it in the National Honor Society. She shouldn't apply to certain schools because she wouldn't make it in, just to have the council pull up her grades and say, oh, you really can go to Vanderbilt. And so those things are happening. But organizations like ours, Nehemiah Churches, we've been teaching personal responsibility forever. But to Henry, I'd like to address something that Henry mentioned. The bulk of my friends, when I was growing up, lived in subsidized housing and had no fathers. And we grew up. We did not become criminals. We obtained degrees. We were the products of Madison Metropolitan School District. And so there's something else that's going on, because I've watched my friends grow up without fathers in their homes. That is terribly alarming. And the African-American leaders are addressing it all the time. But that's not new. The rate at which it's happening is new. But we've watched people overcome this for my entire life. I've watched people who are poor and without fathers succeed. But we have to address the systematic issues. And many of my fellow residents and colleagues don't believe that there are systematic issues that preclude certain students from succeeding at the rate of their white counterparts. And I'm just saying we need both and.
What are some of those systematic issues? What is it? I mean, because that's amazing. What is it at that level that makes the difference between success and failure for how we treat the life of a young kid?
It's perception. It's attitude. If you're not very familiar with someone or their background, there's just certain assumptions that can be made. I have had parents go into parent-teacher conferences to find out that their child was not attending class. And the teacher said, I just stopped marking him absent. So there's absolutely no way for a parent to know that their child is at school and not attending classes. But if the teacher assumes, why put more pressure on the single mom? Why get the kid in greater trouble? Why have a showdown with the mom at a parent-teacher conference? We just won't mark the student absent. Or my growing up in the school district, every year seeing Chapter 7, The Slave Trade, an African with a chain around his neck. We never talked about the Harlem Renaissance. We never talked about the 16 African-American men who were in Congress during Reconstruction. We never talked about civil rights. It's just always the slave chapter. And when you raise your hands and ask, well, what about the contributions of blacks? And your teacher gives you this blank stare. And so you think that that's all you've ever contributed to the world. Well, those things build inside the soul of a kid, and you dread that chapter, because if you've grown up in Madison and you're black, you remember the slave chapter. So they're just systematic things, because you don't have people with a different perspective saying, let's change the images or let's tell the full story. I'm not saying people just get up in the morning and say, let's fail these kids. But when you're fearful of someone or don't know much about them, and you make assumptions about, well, they don't have fathers, they can't succeed, then I need to tell a plethora of my friends who have succeeded and have become business owners and leaders in this community that they shouldn't be because they don't have fathers.
Thanks to Henry for the call. We go now to Mike in Madison. Mike, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Mike Frontier. I'm chairman of Racine County Youth Coalition. At a recent countywide meeting with some African-American youth in mixed group, I was surprised to hear some of our African-American kids from west of the interstate talking about prejudice and a van pulling up and calling the N-word and shooting BBs at them. This was shocking to me. And yet, I'm sure that's reality for some of our black brothers and sisters. My suggestion is we need to move in the area. 23 major cities are working at becoming compassionate cities where they deal with diversity or political differences, and they have forums to address these issues. I think some folks who are prejudiced maybe haven't interacted with people of color. There's a national movement, and it needs to be looked at. Compassion is an antidote to bullying. Let's stop talking about the negatives and put some charters of compassion in place in our political life.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Your response.
I'll never argue against compassion. I think we need all that we can get. What I do find is people become nervous and unsettled when we talk about the issue of racial disparity, because they feel like now you've created a firestorm. Now you're calling things out. We can't fix it if we're ignoring it. So I'm not bringing these issues up to be divisive. I'm stating we're very divisive and we don't even know it. Many African Americans say that if you're in the South, you know where you stand. If you're in rural Georgia, you know certain things, where you go, what you don't. But in places like Wisconsin and Minnesota, where people are so nice, they'll smile at you. But then there are all of these undertones and things that happen behind your back or around you. So I'm just bringing up things to say this is here. They're unspoken. Let's address them. I don't want the messenger to be shot because I'm stating things that might not be obvious. But I'm all about solutions, which is why I spoke up.
You're working toward solutions. You're working toward getting a conversation started here. Let's look forward maybe a year. Where would you like the conversation to be a year from now?
Well, I would like for people I'd like to have a greater sense of a greater consensus that there's something to talk about. I love to see parents talking with their children about issues of race. Do you see a difference between your friends who are African-American or a Latino? I like to see employers feeling more comfortable understanding the issues so that they have strategies to begin to diversify their workforce. Unemployment is probably quadruple that for Black men as it is for our white counterparts in this community. So I think the talk allows people to realize this is not a fad, it's not a phase, this is reality, and we as a community should be outraged. I should not be the only one that's angry. We should realize that we're talking about it, we feel like a sense of community, and there's some group ownership that we are going to work together towards solution and build capacity in the organizations that can address some of the issues like parenting classes or keeping kids from becoming parents when they're younger, staying in school, some supportive organizations that can make a difference. I think that would be a great sign of progress a year from now. That people are saying, we've identified 11 organizations that can help us in addressing these issues. Let's support them.
Reverend G, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We've been speaking with Reverend Alex G. He's pastor at the Fountain of Life Covenant Church and CEO of the nonprofit Nehemiah Center of Urban Leadership.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. Dungeons & Dragons is the single most famous role-playing game in the world, and this year it's celebrating its 40th anniversary. Writer Ethan Gilsdorf didn't grow up in Wisconsin, but his love of D&D led him to fantasize about visiting the game's hometown, Lake Geneva.
The key game really all leads back to two guys, Gary Gygax and David Arneson, and Gary lived in Lake Geneva. I lived halfway across the country. I would get these products in the mail or go to my hobby shop, and it all said,
TSR Hobbies, Dungeons & Dragons game.
This comes from TSR Hobbies, Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, and I thought, where is this magical place, Lake Geneva? And I always wanted to visit there. One of the misconceptions is that it is a game where people dress up in costume and run around in the woods, you know, with swords and armor and so forth. And there are games, of course, that are like that called live-action role-playing games. Dungeons & Dragons really came before all that. And the idea is you're still sitting around a table. It's just like poker night. And one of the players is in charge of the game. He is known or she is known as the Dungeon Master. And this person is kind of the referee and the rule maker. And essentially, when you play, the Dungeon Master says to the assembled players, you know, hey, here's the situation. What do you do? And it's up to the players to decide in that moment what they're going to do.
Survival depends on a quick, decisive move. The choices are limited. Stand and fight or run.
So it's a collaborative game. And this is the other aspect of D&D that was quite new. Most games have a winner and a loser. And, you know, you have 90 minutes to play the game or an afternoon and it's over. D&D is really a story game, and you're essentially telling a story with the players in this Dungeon Master.
Use your lightning bolt.
What's wonderful about the game is that it's had this influence on the whole genre of video games, particularly fantasy role-playing games. It's really spawned a whole genre of stuff, and I think has fed a whole generation of people who get really into Lord of the Rings when those movies came out and get really into Harry Potter when those books came out.
Trying to find a crown, but it's real easy to get lost.
The stereotype is it's a geeky kid who plays these games because he or she doesn't, you know, can't deal with the quote-unquote real world. I feel like D&D taught me how to deal with the real world because it gave me a forum and a venue where I could kind of be goofy and be kind of ballsy and be kind of macho. We do spend more and more time in front of computer screens, but there's very few opportunities left in our culture where you can just sit around and tell a story to each other anymore in a way that's acceptable and normal. And that's what I think is wonderful about the game and other games that are like D&D that, of course, have come along over the years, that it reunites us with this storytelling tradition. Anything can happen. And there's a real sense of wonder and danger and magic and mystery.
Victory is yours.
Ethan Gilsdorf is the author of Fantasy Freaks and Gaming Geeks. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Now we welcome in a Wisconsinite who was influenced by Dungeons & Dragons and the culture it created. John Kovalik is with us in the studio. He's the author of the Dork Tower comic books, a game illustrator and designer himself. John, welcome back to the show.
It's a pleasure being here.
What are your first Dungeons & Dragons D&D memories?
My first D&D memory was finding a tiny little white box with three rules booklets in it in a small game store in London. I grew up in England. I was actually born in England. And this would have been in 1977, I believe. So this was not the very first printing, which came out in 1974. But this was one of the very early printings of Dungeons & Dragons. And I had been playing games in school with my school friends. And I had no idea what a role-playing game was. And it was almost as if you could see my head explode once I realized what this new way of playing games was.
I laugh because my story is so similar. It was a couple of years later, and I got the basic set, and I loved games. And it was, you don't take turns. There's not a board. It's just like the imagination is your only limit. So, yeah, it was a really a mind-altering moment. Well, your work, your graphic art, your comics have been influenced by D&D and the people who play it. Can you talk about its influence on you?
It's been huge. It is. I've been working in the gaming industry, in the games industry, the pen and paper tabletop games industry. I've been working in it for 15, almost 20 years now. And I'm extraordinarily fortunate. I got to know Dave Arneson and Gary Gygax when they were still alive at the conventions. I met them. I deeply regret not having them sign anything, but I was just too in awe. I just wanted to bask in one of the greatest moments of my professional career was at a Gen Con in Milwaukee, walking back to my booth and seeing Dave Arneson buying some of my comic books. And I just sprinted back to the booth saying, "This man's money is not good here. You give him what he wants."
And how pervasive has the D&D gotten in our culture? Not so much even just the game itself, but the ideas, the tropes that come out of it.
Well, it's mainstream now, which is the big difference. People, having gone through the 1980s and the big anti-D&D backlash, the anti-role-playing game backlash, all of the kids who started playing Dungeons & Dragons in the 70s and 80s, many of them now own companies, and many of these companies are in Silicon Valley. And, you know, they've gone on to, it's part of the culture. The tropes are out there. People, you know, there may be some snickering on occasion when you mention magic missiles. But, you know, for the most part, you know, look at how well the Lord of the Rings movies have done. Look at the huge, huge influence Dungeons & Dragons has had on the video gaming industry, and that is just massive.
Do you still play?
I do. Sadly, one of the problems with working in games is you don't have as much time to game as you would like. But I've got a weekly group that meets, and if they're listening to this, they're now laughing because I've not been for a while. But I dearly, dearly miss playing.
Your character's dead. Sorry, man. I hate to break it to you.
Yeah, John's. Yeah, send the dwarf. What's behind that door? Let's use Kovalik's character.
Well, you mentioned Gary Gygax and the Wisconsin connection. There's a group actually working on getting a memorial statue of him. Do you think he gets the credit that is due as a Wisconsin legend, a Wisconsinite who made good?
You know, if Frank Lloyd Wright doesn't get the credit as a Wisconsinite who's made good, Gary Gygax is not. No, he doesn't, because Dungeons & Dragons really changed everything in gaming. And he and Dave Arneson, who was from Minneapolis, so many people owe these guys such a debt of gratitude. They have provided the inspiration for millions of players, boys, girls, men, women, and its profound influence continues to this day. And yes, there absolutely should be a Gygax Memorial in Wisconsin, without a doubt.
I invited comments on our Facebook page, Central Time on WPR, and you can comment, by the way, if you play or have played. Here's a comment from Gavin. He wrote, I loved D&D even since my first game in fifth grade with a few classmates, which was quite memorable due to our teacher calling our parents and explaining how the game is satanic. What I find fascinating is how the game has completely transformed the worlds of fantasy fiction, role-playing games in general, maybe more than Tolkien. The monsters, the character archetypes of D&D have pervaded popular culture. More than the Lord of the Rings, he's saying, D&D shaped what we think of fantasy.
In a sense, you can't argue with that. The whole the fighting man magic user. I mean, D&D took from the classics, from Lord of the Rings, Farfadet and the Grey Mouser, all of the fantasy literature bits and pieces, and it brought it together and melded it into something new.
Is it still as alive as it was back in that heyday in the 70s and into the 80s?
To an extent, yes. I mean, it's no longer just Dungeons and Dragons as the role-playing game. There's some serious contention with a game called Pathfinder, which, in a sense, a lot of people refer to as Dungeons and Dragons 4.75. A big part of 3.75. No, 4.75. I'm getting my editions confused. This is embarrassing. But, you know, the people still gather together. People still, in fact, in a sense, I think there's been a bit of a renaissance in just tabletop gaming as a whole, with people wanting to get back to just gathering a group of friends together and having a good time over the table.
Right. That was something that he mentioned in that Wisconsin Life piece, that a lot of our entertainment is screen oriented. We're at a computer or holding a tablet or a phone or watching TV. Have we been coming full circle and wanting to embrace these things that sit us down in the same place together?
I don't know if it's full circle, but there is a renewed passion for gaming out there, and role-playing games, I think, are right up there.
Do you think it's going to continue, D&D and the other tabletop role-playing games, are they going to continue to be as popular in the future?
Absolutely. There's no substitution just for gathering friends together, for creating characters, for this wonderful interaction you get around the table with a role-playing game.
Briefly, a pep talk for somebody who's never tried it, but their curiosity has been whetted. How do you talk them to doing this stereotypically geeky activity?
I don't know if I could. I would sit them down at the table. I would, first of all, try and find somebody who's a good game master, a good dungeon master. That's essential. And then you just sit down at the table, and they'll know the rules. And in fact, role-playing is a very easy a hobby to get into, because a lot of the times it just takes the one person to know the rules and to get the whole table going.
John, thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely my pleasure.
That's John Kovalik, comic book artist, game designer, and illustrator. And again, you can post your gaming memories at the Central Time Facebook page.